The election of 2016 exposed some fundamental divisions within conservative intellectual culture. It is perhaps somewhat urgent, then, for us to consider the deepest theological and philosophical roots of our policy prescriptions and political activities. One of the central debates within American conservatism, at least at Hillsdale College, is over the role of natural rights and tradition in a coherent political philosophy. Some conservative advocates of a politics based upon natural rights point to the healthy classical liberalism of the American founding and even John Locke, contend that many of the problems of modern political discourse find their roots in German idealism, and argue that a return to the principles of the Declaration of Independence will renew our politics. Of course, these principles are that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Surprised we didn't recite that together. Victor Munoz has sensibly referred to this perspective as natural rights statesmanship. Others have called it sustainable or natural law liberalism. For ease of discussion, with all of its problems, I'll refer to this way of thinking as natural rights conservatism. On the other hand, those advocating the thought of Edmund Burke and Russell Kirk, traditionalist conservatives or paleoconservatives, are today hesitant about natural rights, in part because of the excesses and abuses of the concept in contemporary social and political controversies. Indeed, some natural law liberals accuse Burkeans of rejecting natural rights altogether, though we should not forget that Burke himself said in the 1770s that, quote, "the natural rights of mankind are indeed sacred things. If any public measure is proved mischievously to affect them, the obligation ought to be fatal to that measure, even if no charter at all could be set against it. If these natural rights are further affirmed and declared by express covenants and secured against power by written instruments, they are in a still better condition." There are some in the traditionalist conservative current who see Locke and even the American founders as laying the groundwork for later liberalism, some of the concerns of our own day. One proponent of this view says that, quote, "the trajectory of the founders' liberal logic, making protection of sovereign choice and individual appetite the main object of government, leads with nearly inexorable certainty to an outcome such as we now witness today. Instead of appeals to natural rights that supposedly isolate individuals from the obligations of citizenship, Burkeans emphasize organic community, local patriotism, the cultural inheritance of our ancestors, and the civilizing role of tradition and custom. They speak of a covenant or a partnership between those who are living, those who are dead, and those who are to be born." If I may briefly wax autobiographical for just a moment, I have often been frustrated with aspects of this debate because I find myself agreeing with key elements of both sides. As an American, I've always wanted to affirm, almost always, the importance of the individual in the political community, claims and norms that transcend any customary framework or local culture, natural rights, the consent of the governed, and the right to resist tyrants. But like the Kirkians, I also believed that politics wasn't instrumental, merely a tool for my own self-preservation. Tradition, custom, local networks of association enrich human life. Indeed, our Anglo-American convictions about natural rights arose within particular historical, social, and cultural context that shouldn't be ignored, even though they're not the full explanation. I worried that it was perhaps just my own muddle-headed thinking that drew me to both natural rights and Kirkian conservatism. I just want it both ways. I'm a compromiser by nature. Burdened by this anxiety about the clarity of my own thinking, I stumbled upon the Thomistic tradition of political thought several years ago. The Thomism of the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, I realized, was not only a resource for a theologically and metaphysically rich political philosophy, but also provided another way, perhaps not the only way, of uniting the rational defense of politics rooted in human nature with an appropriately cautious deference to custom, tradition, and the ethos of the political community into which one is born. So tonight, I'd like to draw upon a few followers of Thomas Aquinas who lived between 1500 and 1800. I'll be mentioning quite a few rather obscure names, but I hope this won't be too disorienting. because I'm focusing on the points that they have in common. Their particular contexts are not my central concern in this lecture. While Dominican and Jesuit theologians of this period fought about grace, free choice, and a wide variety of theological and metaphysical doctrines, they all agreed that Aquinas' 13th century reflections on law and justice in the second part of the Summa Theologiae were a point of departure for political reflection. A whole genre of treatises, De Justitia et Iure, on justice and right, were produced between the 16th and 18th centuries. These treatises certainly extended Thomistic insights, integrating the theological ethics of the Summa with a detailed examination of Roman law, applying many of these conclusions to contemporary controversies like the conquest of the New World, the emergence of Machiavellianism, divine right monarchy, and the wars of religion. My primary source, however, will be the Jesuit, I'm really sorry, everybody, Francisco Suarez, who lived from 1548 to 1617, taught in the schools of his order in Salamanca, Rome, and Coimbra. So I'll begin by sketching this account of natural rights, related doctrines in the tradition, and then I'll turn to, in a brief way, to ways in which the Thomistic teachings on natural right part ways from other early modern thinkers, not necessarily all of them, especially when it comes to the role of custom in political life. And if we have time in Q&A, I'd love to have your reflections on how useful to contemporary discourse these ideas might be. Despite the fact that the doctrine of natural rights is still frequently associated with John Locke and the early Enlightenment, medieval canon lawyers played a role in the development of the idea. Jus naturale, traditionally was often a synonym for natural law. In the 12th century, however, the elements of jus naturale that didn't quite fit standard definitions of law as binding precept for community began to be drawn out. In the 12th and 13th centuries, certain church lawyers talked about having a right or claim under natural law, not civil or positive law, to property, rights of consent to government, a right of self-defense, a right to marry without compulsion, procedural rights. Basic rules of legal procedure, these canon lawyers said, were based on the natural right of self-defense, not only on human law. These natural rights were claims, not binding precepts or laws. Canon lawyers often drew upon Paul's words to the Corinthians, "All things are licit to me." They did this to flesh out another sense of jus naturale, or natural right. And this is a canon lawyer of the time. "Something licit and approved, neither commanded nor forbidden by the Lord or by any statute, to reclaim one's own or not to reclaim it, to eat something or not to eat it." There's this zone of freedom that the scholar Brian Tierney has talked about it. As another canon lawyer puts it, "All things are licit to me," Paul said, "which concern food. They are licit by the power of free choice and by natural law." By the early 16th century at Paris and elsewhere, there were rather extensive and fine-grained discussions of natural right over the course of those centuries. But again, according to Tierney, quote, "the technical argumentation about jus right often seems to degenerate into a mere scholastic wordplay that was drifting away from any constructive engagement with contemporary issues. Perhaps in part because of the technical usage of the notion around the turn of the 16th century, the doctrine does not feature prominently in the most important political reflections of the Renaissance humanists, like Thomas More's Utopia, and in a very different key, Niccolo Machiavelli's The Prince. Natural rights are not a major element in those works. The renewal of talk of natural rights, though, did not wait until the work of Hugo Grotius or Hobbes's Leviathan. While Dominican theologians sought to understand the conquest of the New World by Spain, and often to defend the native peoples from oppression, they turned to the language of rights. So this is a key moment in the development of the doctrine. Of course, they also appealed in the defense of these native peoples to the Christian obligations to love one's neighbor. But rights talk gave Spanish theologians like Francisco de Vitoria and Domingo de Soto resources for articulating the claims that the native people of the New World had as human beings. Even though the Indians were not part of Christendom, they were not part of the old Roman Empire, they had rights by nature, simply by virtue of their membership in the human race. This idea was an important resource for Dominican priests concerned about the well-being of the native people of the Americas. Francisco de Vitoria at the University of Salamanca argued that humans are the only beings in the material order of things that have rights, that no human being can be the property of another person or a slave by nature, thus undermining the attempt to use the natural inequality of man in Aristotle to support the enslavement of the Indians in the New World. Rather, he said, all men had rights, including the right of self-defense, which is part of why no man had a natural right to rule any other man. Government must, therefore, he said, arise from consent, which is one of many reasons why the Spanish conquest was so problematic for Vitoria. They did not consent to this rule. In a public lecture at Salamanca in 1535, Vitoria's student, Domingo de Soto, asked, by what right do we maintain rule in the lands being discovered across the Atlantic? This was his opening question to the whole community. While his teacher, Vitoria, found a few possible justifications for war and conquest, Soto responded quite frankly, in truth, I do not know. Ego nescio. On the ground in the New World, a few decades earlier, the Dominican Antonio de Montesinos, a preacher in Hispaniola, preached on the fourth Sunday of Advent in 1511 and also used the language of rites. He said, and I'll quote at length, I am the voice of Christ in the desert of this island. It would be wise of you to pay attention and to listen with your whole heart and with every fabric of your being. You are all in mortal sin. You live in it, you die in it, all because of the cruel tyranny you exercise against these innocent peoples. Tell me, by what right and with what justice do you so violently enslave these Indians? How can you work them to death, all for your insatiable thirst for gold? Are they not human beings? Do they not have rational souls? Are you not obligated to love them as you love yourselves? Do you not understand this? Do you not feel this? Here, Montesinos invoked the Christian account of man as made in the image of God and the obligation to love our neighbors as ourselves, but he also talked about the rational souls of the Native Americans, the fact that they are human beings, and the absence of any right to treat them as had become common. After an angry band went to the Dominican house, led by Christopher Columbus's son Diego, the whole community of Dominicans, formed into a mystic teaching and canon law, responded to the crowd that all of the friars agreed with Montesinos. And in the sermon of the following week, Montesinos rose to the front of the church and preached that whoever did not free their Indian slaves would not be absolved in the confessional. The most famous Dominican priest in the New World, Bartolomé de las Casas, heard this kind of preaching, which is what encouraged him to join the order. He also defended the Indians on the basis of their humanity. Quote, all the peoples of the world are humans. There is only one definition of all human beings and of each one. That is that they are rational. Thus, all the races of humankind are one. In this context, Las Casas didn't merely speak of the absence of a right on the part of the Spanish conquistadors and slavers, but spoke at great length about the rights of the Indians. He explicitly stated that liberty was a right implanted in man. Liberty was, he said, more precious and priceless than any riches a people might possess. This liberty of all men gave people a right to institute rulers by consent. And speaking of riches, Las Casas argued that after rulers were instituted by consent, they only acquired jurisdiction, the power of lawmaking and judgment, not ownership of their subjects' property. Indeed, consent was a precondition for the imposition of taxes, because liberty was not lost after the choice to form a government. Of course, Las Casas believed all of this in theory, but the continued freedom of all political communities by natural right was a doctrine in service of the rights of the Indians. Even if the rulers of the Indians had supposedly forfeited land and rule to the Spanish crown, Las Casas argued that such alienation was not in a king's power. He didn't have the right to give up those lands. The citizens must freely consent to any alienation. All of these natural rights were, he said, fixed and immutable. The defense of the Indians is then a critical context for the emergence of subjective natural rights in the Thomistic theological tradition. But even after the important use of natural rights in this important moment, the subjective dimension of rights as a possession or a claim rooted in one's nature was still used alongside jus naturale understood in an objective sense. So there's a subjective and objective element. Thomas Aquinas, the major source for all of these Spanish Dominicans, employed the word jus or right as the object of justice, as what is right. Now, he occasionally took the term in a more or less subjective way, but I would agree with many scholars that he did not have a teaching of subjective natural rights. This is a development that came later. So the question is it a corruption of Aquinas or a development of Aquinas? Something we could talk about. An important crystallization of this scholastic notion of subjective natural rights took place in Francisco Suarez's early 17th century work on the laws. He defined right, in contrast with law, as, quote, a certain moral power which every man has, either over his own property or with respect to that which is due to him. And this is the true object of justice, evoking Aquinas. Right is not just what is right or what is just. Rather, it is, quote, that by which the owner of a thing is said to have a right in that thing. The laborer is said to have a right to his wages, by reason of which he is declared worthy of his hire. This sort of right, Suarez says, is also a right to claim. Law or lex was, by contrast, briefly defined by Suarez as, quote, a common, just, and stable precept which has been sufficiently promulgated. But this distinction of right from law isn't, at this point, explicit about natural rights. But later in the laws, Suarez says that jus, understood as a moral right to acquire or retain something, can be called natural when it is granted by or originates within nature, as liberty may be said to spring from the natural law. In his work, in reply to the absolutism of King James VI and I of England, Suarez said, the natural right of liberty is given by God. Elsewhere, he talks of the right to liberty not only as natural to man, but as his great perfection. Suarez wrote, if one acts in defense of his very life, which the king is attempting to take violently from him, so this has real consequences, these rights, Suarez says, it will ordinarily be permissible for the subject to defend himself, even though the death of the king result from such defense. For the right to preserve one's life is the greatest right. Later in the same section on slaying tyrants, Suarez says that one might kill a tyrant by the authority of God, the author of nature, who gives to every individual the power of defending the innocent. There are constraints, but we see these rights. The right, the natural right of life, the natural right to self-preservation, to self-defense, defending the innocent, to liberty, the right to what is one's own. Scholastics also developed notions of dominion, which is a related notion. A dominion over one's own body, a dominion over one's actions, honor, and reputation. This principle of a right in one's own body was used in sometimes rather astonishing ways. Another 17th century Jesuit, Leonardo Lessius, argued that the man who seduced a virgin was not liable to the family for the loss of its daughter's reputation, as long as the girl actually consented to the sinful act. This is based on the fact that, in Lessius' words, the girl is the master, domina, mistress, of her own body. This girl is still committing a sin against the natural law and against the Christian faith, but her mastery over her own actions and body make her morally responsible. As we've already seen in the Dominican defense of the Native Americans, these natural rights had political implications. It's not just dominion over your own situation. Members of the School of Salamanca even articulated this inborn right of freedom in terms of equality. Freedom and equality. Suarez said, because all men are born free, or sui juris, of their own right, no man has political jurisdiction over another by nature. Suarez's Italian confrere, Roberto Bellarmino, put it even more clearly. All men are equal, not in wisdom, not in grace, but in the essence and the nature of mankind. The connection of this natural freedom and equality to their account of the origin of political power is quite explicit. If no man is naturally subject to another man, the subjection of the political order must be voluntary in at least some respects. As Francisco de Vitoria put it, prior to the creation of commonwealths, no man was the superior of any other. Bellarmine said, there is no reason why among equals one should rule rather than another. He reminded kings of his day, let rulers remember that they preside over men who are of the same nature as they themselves. Suarez said that man was made in the image of God and of his own right, and created subject to God alone before this consent occurs. He immediately takes up a possible objection rooted in this very account of human liberty, that no man should ever be under the subjection of any other man. Even the direction of a good government occupied with the good of the community would offend man's natural liberty. Without in any way attenuating his account of man's natural freedom, Suarez responds, though man is created free, yet he can be subjected to another for a cause that is just and a cause that is consonant with reason. It is only because the subjection of individuals to government is in conformity with right reason and necessary for the convenient conservation of human nature that it is fitted to man's natural freedom. Such political authority must come from the consent of the political community, which Suarez calls a moral, mystical, or corporate body. The corporation of a political community is, he says, a fictive person, which then gives authority to the one, the few, or the many, or retains it for itself. The terms of this covenant or pactum, which is the word he tends to use, a kind of contract between the people and the government, are binding on the political authority. And natural rights are not surrendered, but established in these pacts. As Las Casas said, civil reason can extinguish civil rights, but not natural rights. The natural rights, what one can morally claim from another man on the basis of natural human reason, these rights are preserved in the political order. Given the wide range of options for how a community might choose to be governed, Suarez asked the interesting question about whether the original pact might have established that any form of resistance to a tyrannical government was forbidden. If a man can sell himself into servitude, as many of the scholastics believed, why can't the community completely alienate all legitimate uses of violence in every situation to the monarch? In other words, why can't the pact say, we will never resist you under any circumstances? Here is Suarez's response. If a legitimate king is governing tyrannically, and no other remedy is at hand for the self-defense of the kingdom but to drive out and depose him, then the whole commonwealth, by means of a public council of the citizenry, of the commons, and of the nobles, may depose him. This would be allowed both by the law of nature, which permits one to resist force with force, so you have that right to self-defense, and also because the case requiring action for the very salvation of the commonwealth is always understood, always, as accepted in the first compact by which the commonwealth transfers its power to the king. You might talk about this as an inalienable right to self-defense on the part of the community. The natural right of self-defense is part of why these early modern Thomists never affirmed the irresistibility of the state, as many philosophers did in the 17th and 18th centuries. Besides the conquest of the New World, another context for this emergence of these doctrines, I think, is the emergence of divine right absolutism in the 16th and 17th centuries. No pact between people and government could alienate the power to resist tyranny because government exists for the common good. Rodrigo Arriaga, another Jesuit, says that it is not only permissible but obligatory to resist tyranny in certain cases. In his words, whenever a tyrant can receive an occasion from any act of obedience for his tyranny to be confirmed, no one can legitimately obey him. So there is a kind of duty to a certain kind of resistance, it seems. Juan de Mariana, probably the most notorious of the tyrannicides, puts the point quite vividly, and I will quote it at length. A tyrant is like a ferocious and monstrous animal that strikes out in all directions, destroys, rips apart, burns everything, causing horrible slaughters with claws, teeth, and horns. Should there not be praise for anyone who risks his own life to restore the safety of the people? Now, princes should not be changed too easily, lest greater evils occur, light and transient causes. But if princes oppress the commonwealth and are intolerable because of their vices and foulness, it is a good idea to remind them that they can be killed, not only lawfully, but with praise and glory, if they continue to live in this evil way. Perhaps fear might deter kings from allowing themselves to become completely corrupted by vice and flattery. Even when the government is not acting in such a way that demands tyrannicide, it needs to be limited in its aims. Partly because of their view of the inborn right to freedom, the scholastics, arguably like natural rights conservatives today, seem to limit the aims of the state. They qualify what the idea of the common good really involves. Suarez says, "The civil legislative power does not have for its intrinsic end the happiness of the future life. It does not even have for its end the proper felicity of the present life insofar as it pertains to individual men in their aspects as particular persons." So not a heavenly end, not even the happiness of individuals as such, Suarez says. Rather, its end is the natural felicity for the perfect human community and of individual men in their aspect as members of such a city, that they might live in it in peace and justice with a sufficiency of those goods that relate to the preservation and comfort of bodily life. So a rather external account of the purposes of the government. Suarez is not alone here. Bellarmine says that the end of political power is temporal external peace. Arriaga uses this basic externality of the civic dimensions of individual human life to determine the limits of a subject's obligations to his or her government. He says that a man's actions done in complete privacy do not pertain to his obligations as a public person, as a member of the commonwealth, morally one with others in his city. These actions, rather, are done by him as a solitary man, not as a member of the community, and these hidden actions do not fall under the civil law at all. For these Thomists, there is a kind of sphere of independence from the civic order that involves a limitation on the legitimate actions of the government. But while this talk of a sphere of independence or zones of freedom would please the natural rights conservatives, isn't this the very sort of language that the traditionalist conservatives are worried about? Does this language, springing from the emergence of a subjective natural rights, lose touch with objective right, the cosmic justice of a Cicero and an Aquinas? Does this not move towards the rights of Thomas Hobbes and others? As I mentioned at the outset, many commentators have just entirely ignored these scholastic doctrines of natural rights. But when they are discussed, they are often seen, for good or for ill, as the precursor of Locke or even Hobbes. These scholarly perspectives, however, have failed to take into consideration the fact that scholastics didn't disappear in the 17th century. Francis Bacon, René Descartes had some harsh criticisms of Scholasticism, but Franciscans, Jesuits, and Dominicans did not retreat to their houses of study. They continued to engage the learned culture of their day. Hobbes was generally the main opponent for scholastic natural law treatises in the 17th and 18th centuries. Of course, he starkly divided jus and lex, right and law. We have freedom and we have obligation. And this freedom is a freedom to anything necessary for self-preservation, even up to the body of another man. And so that's the conception of right that we have here. Another figure in the 17th century, Baruch Spinoza, puts it even more clearly. He says, "By the right and order of nature, I merely mean the rules determining the nature of each individual thing by which we conceive it is determined naturally to exist and to behave in a certain way. For example, fish are determined by nature to swim. Big fish eat little fish. And therefore, it is by a natural right that fish have possession of the water and that big fish eat small fish." So we have a view of natural right as physical power that fish share in. One 18th century Jesuit, a writer, Jakob Zwinger, who ended up having not, he wasn't actually writing as a Jesuit because the Jesuit order was abolished for a time, makes it clear that rights are not physical powers, but moral powers. He wants to make this crystal clear. Rights can be called legitimate faculties, legal faculties. They are not referred to man's bodily capacities, as arguably for Hobbes and Spinoza, but rather they are referred to the honestas morum, the honorableness of morality. It's not a matter of physical power or capacity. When Daniel Concina, an 18th century Dominican moral theologian, responds directly to Hobbes, Pufendorf, and other modern treatments of natural rights, one of his main concerns was to establish that the human will does not establish what is right and wrong. We don't create with our will what is just. As he said, "We defend absolutely that before all human law, good and evil are in things." Concino thinks that abstracting rights and human actions from the moral order leads to chaos. Well, Hobbes would agree. And at the very least, to rights conflict. He thinks it's very problematic to think that two men have a right to one thing. But they don't in a moral conception of right, but they do in a physical conception of right. The universe is not based on chaotic power struggles of human beings asserting their rights, understood as pure power. To the extent that that does happen, Concino argues, it is a sin, not our natural condition. Man is a social animal, and this sociality is the foundation of the norms which are prior to every human law and prior to every human right. Moral claims that we have, natural rights, Concino argues, can only be understood in the context of man's social nature, in the context of justice and the natural law. Interestingly enough, Locke does not seem to be a central concern in the natural law treatises of the 18th century. Perhaps I'm missing something, but he doesn't come up very often. It is perhaps noteworthy that in one of these references, the worry of the 18th century Dominican Salvatore Rosselli was that Locke's doctrine of the natural right to property would undermine the property rights of those who haven't acquired their possessions by industry or by mixing their labor with the earth. Rosselli says that if landowners don't have a full right to their superfluities, it would undermine the precept of charity, which requires us to give out of our superfluous goods. Unfairly or no, Rosselli thinks that Locke made anyone a thief who held land beyond what is required for their necessities. So in reply to Locke, Rosselli defended those who stored up goods just in case chance events might arise. So again, I'm not endorsing this view of Locke, but it's interesting that the Dominican says we want a more robust private property right. He also expressed concern, again, perhaps incorrectly, that Locke measured virtue or vice on the approval or disapproval of these actions by the consent of the nations. He thought that this weakened Locke's claim that he affirmed that actions are good or evil by nature. Rosselli worried that Locke was slipping towards the positions of Hobbes and Spinoza. It is noteworthy that our Dominican here thought that Locke did not respect reason enough in the moral order. In contrast with a view of morality based upon approved usages in the community, this 18th century Dominican saw himself as aligned, this is what he says, with Plato, Aristotle, and Aquinas against Thrasymachus, Democritus, Carneades, Epicurus, the skeptics, the materialists, and others, all of whom reduce what is good and evil by nature to nothing but opinion. These good and evil actions are based upon a moral order, the right reason that agrees with human nature and distinguishes human beings from beasts. So these early modern defenses of a scholastic account of natural rights focused on human nature and focused on these natural rights as rooted in a moral order. These natural rights were moral qualities and powers rather than physical capacities. Of course, once again, many of the natural rights conservatives today would agree with this account. Now, some Burkean conservatives might be put somewhat at ease. This is not just pure assertions of power. But perhaps, even then, all of this is a bit too abstract. One of our Dominicans in dialogue with Locke had the chance to affirm the idea that the species is wise, that long-standing approval and rich customary frameworks, rather than right reason alone, guide our moral reasoning. Why couldn't this scholastic appreciate Locke's supposed reliance on widespread approval for understanding what is virtuous? Now, Rosselli seems to have taken up this concern in his opposition to another Englishman, John Selden. So we're heading towards the finish line here. Rosselli wanted to defend the Thomistic idea that natural law is promulgated in that God instilled it into man's mind so as to be known by him naturally. So he wants natural law instilled in our reason. By contrast, Selden argued that God handed down natural law by tradition to the human race after the flood, to the sons of Noah. Rosselli did not see that this way of tradition was the right approach. Natural law is promulgated by virtue of the fact that the human intellect participates in the divine intellect. But at the same time, Rosselli has no problem with the idea that divine revelation, that kind of tradition, confirms practical truths, and such revealed doctrines do not destroy, but perfect natural reason. So this Dominican is no rationalist, of course. The only issue is if the traditionalists entirely deny the force of reason. Indeed, it is not only divine revelation, but any kind of tradition of teaching that can, Rosselli says, confirm the knowledge drawn out of the light of reason. So tradition can be a confirmation of what we've learned by reason. What we see here is that while the Thomists have a high view of reason against some of the traditionalists of their own day, they do acknowledge that our reason can be given material, be provided direction through tradition and custom. These Thomists do not oppose reason to convention. Customary usages that last a long time can tell us something about the way that rational animals actually live in the world. Instead of juxtaposing reason and tradition, or logic and moral imagination, these early modern Thomists offer a rational defense of the importance of custom in any real community, as long as it's subordinated in some ways to reason. Suarez accounts for the fundamental role of custom in a polis by returning to the idea of the natural freedom of human beings and the communities made up of human beings. He says, the capacity for making laws resides in political communities, even those with a king, which shows that they can continue to make laws with their usages, with their actions. He says, there is no difference between written and customary laws, since their subject matter should be morally good, adapted to the public weal, and finally reasonable. Reason is the soul of both kinds of law, written law and customary law. Custom can check arbitrary actions of government. It can be part of interpreting law as the people receive it. As Suarez says, custom becomes second nature. A change in it is not easily made. All governments, he says, have an obligation to respect custom because, he he says, laws should be in harmony with the general conduct of the people who observe the laws. So this customary framework is what allows us to live freely and to have our lives in harmony with law rather than having these arbitrary commands. To conclude, the scholastics of the early modern period developed a notion of subjective natural rights to confront the brutality of the conquistadors of the New World. The Native Americans were part of the human race and therefore had claims upon their own lands, the governments that they had established, their own liberty, and their lives. They deployed a view of a natural right to freedom to oppose divine right monarchs emerging in this period, who argued either that the political community made no contribution to their power or that the political community had surrendered all authority to the king, making the sovereign irresistible. The scholastics responded that the right to self-defense was inalienable. The body or corporation of the people could defend the common good if a king or senate opposed it. Individuals had all sorts of rights, one of which was the right to act in a range of ways in keeping with right reason, as long as those acts were not forbidden by just laws. How should our narratives of Western political philosophy change to accommodate the fact that all of these ideas were well in place by the turn of the 17th century? Could natural rights conservatives enrich their thinking in any way by having these Thomists as interlocutors? Traditionalist conservatives, on the other hand, might benefit from engaging with the fact that natural rights, consent of the governed, pacts between governments and the people, the right of resistance, all emerged well before the Enlightenment. And they need not worry that these rights will become mere assertions of individual power or will or appetite. Rights are defined by the scholastics as moral powers, moral faculties, which must be in harmony with natural law, right reason, and the social character of human beings. And the scholastics also suggest that tradition and custom are not things that are set against reason, but things that can confirm and enrich reason. Indeed, they show that there is a robust rational defense of the need for governments to respect custom. They are rationally defending tradition. Custom teaches us how laws might be in harmony with the conduct of law-abiding people. Customs help us to avoid the assertions of arbitrary power. Custom reflects the continued lawmaking power of a political community. These scholastics certainly didn't think that we could make the world anew. They criticized 17th century contemporaries who thought that they alone enjoyed the midday light of truth. But they also opposed those who thought that right reason provided little guidance. They would not embrace the conservatism at times seen in the works of Montaigne and David Hume, which thought of reason as inimical to social harmony. The scholastics believed that man's rational powers, rightly understood, could balance logos and ethos, the rights and duties of the individual, and one's rights and duties as a member of a political community. Perhaps such an account of reason could help American conservatives avoid both rationalism and a traditionalism suspicious of reason as we look forward and think about this gift to man, which Aristotle calls reason, which Aristotle calls the divine element that is in us. All right, thank you very much. Thank you.